Together we will stand, fight until fall. Come on now, people, let's get on the ball and work together. Come on, let's work together.
Do it, children.
Now, people, say now, together we will stand. Every boy, girl, woman, and man. Oh, yeah.
Master.
Good morning. And welcome to Neighbors on KUMD. A new show on our program for Tuesdays and Thursdays, kind of taking a look at the strange new times in which we find ourselves and maybe sharing some coping strategies, keeping folks abreast of what is going on as the situation continues to change. This is a topic that we talked about way back at the beginning in March, when we were first getting used to the whole COVID-19 thing, and obviously it occurred to someone that a shelter in place and stay at home and don't leave the house was going to work well for just about everybody except folks for whom home is not safe. We've been a couple of months into the process now. Brittany Robb is the executive director of Safe Haven Shelter and Resource Center, and she joins us this morning on the phone to kind of bring us up to date. Hi, Brittany. Good morning.
Good morning, Lisa. Thanks for having me on.
I watched a news story on NBC earlier this week that said that they had reached out to a bunch of different women's shelters in a bunch of different states, and they said that calls for help to hotlines had more than doubled in some spots, but they were also shorter and the people were more frantic. What's going on here in our community?
Yeah, you know, at Safe Haven, when the stay-at-home order first went into effect earlier this spring, what we saw was really frightening. We saw a really dramatic spike in the number of calls coming into our hotline at our shelter site. So we saw that folks were reaching out to us at a higher rate, we noticed about an 11% increase in our call volume on a daily basis. And we did experience exactly that. People were calling at a higher frequency, but the length of their call with us on an individual basis was much shorter. So they wanted really fast information. They wanted really fast help and really short solutions to really complex problems. And then over time and over the past few weeks and the longer the stay-at-home order has lasted, we saw an even greater concern that our calls, we've experienced a significant decline, and we're at about 60% of our normal call volume right now. I just checked our numbers right before I got on the phone with you today, and we're at 88 calls for what we would typically expect to be well over 100, probably closer to about 150. And so what we anecdotally know to be true and what we've heard from the survivors that we've been able to still reach and interact with is that they are being even further isolated because they are home with their abusive partners and they're not able to access even their phones to make a simple phone call to reach out to us for help and support.
One of the things that is implicit in abuse, and which when it happens, it's kind of a warning sign that something is going wrong and something could be going further wrong down the line. But because it doesn't involve physical violence, we don't identify it, is the way that an abuser will deliberately try to isolate a person from their family, from their friends, from the rest of the world. And now This isolating is kind of being done for them. Mm-hmm. Are you concerned about women or people who might be in a relationship that could be moving toward that kind of abuse? That could be psychologically abusive. Because the abuser or the potential abuser has kind of had this situation handed to them, that they're taking full advantage of it.
Yep, very much so. That, you know, isolation is oftentimes one of the first abusive tactics that an abuser or a potential abuser will take to further control their victim and their partner. And so, you know, just like you said, Lisa, this is just kind of an opportunity that's being handed to them. And, you know, no disrespect to the governor in an effort to keep all of us safe from the threat of COVID, which is very much a real thing and something we all need to take seriously. But what we are seeing and noticing and hearing from survivors and what we know based on our experience is that isolation is oftentimes one of the first tactics that abusers will take. And so we are asking people to look out for one another in that way as well. So if you notice that there is, you know, a friend that you would typically hear from, or, you know, your cousin or your sister or a colleague that you would typically kind of hear from on a regular basis, and you know that they are, you know, living and being isolated with someone right now, they're quarantining with someone, and you haven't heard from them in a while, we would hope that you would just reach out to them and check on them and make sure they're okay and just, you know, say, hey, I'm thinking about you, and, you know, kind of feel that out a little bit. So that would always be, you know, the first step and the first recommendation from our agency is to just always reach out and make sure that, you know, you're still doing your best to stay connected to the people that are in your life and in your circle, even though we're physically distant from one another.
Now, this is the kind of thing that would have been easy in the past. You would have maybe called somebody up at work, or you would have touched base. You would have maybe sent them a text and figured they'd read it on their phone when they were at work. There would have been opportunities for you to connect with people when they were not at home, when they were not right with the abuser or perhaps the potential abuser. In this instance now, you kind of got to figure that most of the time that you'd be trying to contact them, you know, depending on their work situation, much of the time when you'd be trying to contact them, their abuser's going to be right there. Is it still safe?
It's a really difficult question to answer because everybody's situation is so different. And, you know, with a lot of folks using social media, we do our best to put our messaging out there and, you know, to do it kind of just generally but also discreetly. We try to put our phone number on everything and make our contact information accessible so that folks are able to reach us directly. What we encourage people to do is to, you know, send private messages to their friends via social media as well. Sometimes that might be the quickest way to get in touch with someone. Oftentimes those messages can go really quickly and then be deleted really quickly. Abusers are very crafty, and they do oftentimes, you know, tend to hover and monitor. And so, you know, being really quick to send the fastest message or to make the quickest phone call or the fastest text, and then being able to, you know, delete the browser history or delete the message that has just been sent is going to be the safest way to be able to reach out and maintain contact. And so we also encourage folks that are reaching out to their friends that they may be concerned about is to be very sort of vague in the way in which they're sending messages. So rather than coming right out and being like, hey, I think you might, you know, be in an abusive situation.
Say, is that idiot refusing to let you, to let you out of the house? Maybe not a good plan.
Right, exactly. You know, just kind of extending a general message of, hey, you know, you're on my mind. I'm thinking about you and just want to make sure you're doing all right. Do you need anything? You know, could we schedule a time to chat or something like that? And just that's, you know, sort of what I mean by feeling it out, just making sure that people always know that you're thinking about them. And I think sometimes, you know, friends and family sort of have this sense of, you know, we've got to save this person and we've got to fix the situation for them. But really, you know, survivors have survived this long and they know how to keep themselves safe better than even we do as, you know, quote unquote, the experts in the field as advocates. And so take their lead, take the lead of the survivors that are living the situation, and really just kind of, you know, massage that situation and do the best you can to always let people know that you're going to be there for them, and be discreet and loving and kind, and know that, you know, just even planting that seed of support is going to go a long way for the future, so that maybe they're not going to reach out to you right now. But once they have the ability to do so, they're going to remember that you were there for them, and you might be the first person that they'll reach out to once it's safe to do so.
And the stakes are high, aren't they? Mm-hmm. That you to extend your support, but you do it appropriately, and you don't come in and try to take charge, because you won't bear the repercussions.
That's right. Yep.
So what are you recommending to people? I suppose maybe a lot of us think that if there's a situation with domestic violence that we may hear yelling or dishes breaking. Well, that certainly is possible. But is that always the case? Are there other signs that we could look for that maybe something's not right in the life of a friend or a coworker, somebody we care about?
What I always tell people is, you know, trust your instincts. If something doesn't feel right to you, it's probably not. And so if you notice, you know, specific things, you know, you have a friend who your relationship just doesn't really feel right. Maybe they have a new partner in their life. And, you know, I always have to kind of put this disclaimer out there that just, you know, just because something isn't right doesn't always mean it's domestic violence. But don't rule that out either. You know, don't talk yourself out of it. So, you know, if someone starts to not make eye contact with you, you know, they're not reaching out to you anymore. They used to share all kinds of details with you about their life and their relationship, and then all of a sudden they're not anymore. If you notice they're, and again, these kind of are social interaction cues, but also important to know for the future as well. If you go out for coffee but they need to ask for permission to do so, or if they have to ask for permission to do like a social, like a Zoom happy hour with you or something like that, you know, those are kind of all red flags. I think also one of the things too to just be really mindful of is how often your instincts are telling you like something is not right here. And so just always listen to your intuition. And always reach out to people who you're thinking of that something might not be going so well in their life.
One final question for you, Brittany. What about people that may be in a new relationship, and maybe they are quarantining with this person? Maybe they're not, but folks that care about them are already starting to worry about, gee, that, you know, I just never see you anymore, and it seems like you're always with your new partner, and there's never any time for me, that kind of thing. Are there some early intervention, for the lack of a better phrase, are there some early intervention things that friends and concerned people can do to maybe gently point something out or whatever? Because at the beginning, it can almost be seen as flattering. He loves me so much, he doesn't want to be without me.
Right. I think that is the balance that needs to be found. And with each relationship, it's going to be different. And, you know, what I hear all the time from people kind of peripheral to the relationship of survivors is, you know, what could I have said? What could I have done? And what I tell them all the time is, you know, just tell and show that person how much you love and care about them, and let them know that you will always be there for them. Because, you know, as I mentioned before, they will reach out when they are ready to do so. And knowing that you are going to be that person for there without judgment, you know, without shame, without blame, is going to be the number one thing that you can do. And also making sure that that person that you care about and love knows that services are available to them. And even letting them know, like, hey, you know, I've noticed that this part of your relationship isn't something that I might want for myself. Have you thought about that? And just kind of having those conversations. So doing so, again, without judgment, without blame, without shame, I think is absolutely the way to go. Because the more a person feels like they're going to be met with a response of, I told you so, or didn't I tell you that that was going to, you know, go such and such a way, the less likely they are going to be to reach out to you for help and support in the future. And so, you know, as hard as it is, always, you know, be respectful of that person's choices and what they are doing in their life, and you know, constantly just reminding them that, you know, you love them, you care about them, you're there for them no matter what.
Well, they're really being undermined in their other relationship, and to have even the most well-meaning person indicate that they think you're an idiot too is not helpful. One final thing, you and I talked about this yesterday. We know how important it is to let survivors and people that are struggling through a situation like this know you can get help, you can get services, and you can bring your animals. They will keep your animals safe too.
Absolutely. Yep, at Safe Haven we have this philosophy that pets are family too. And so, you know, everyone is welcome at Safe Haven, regardless of gender identity or species. So you're welcome at Safe Haven, and you're welcome to bring your pets. And so please do, you know, reach out to us, you know, by phone, email, social media. I saw a really great thing that I wish I could take ownership for, but I can't. I'll give credit where credit is due. One of my friends on Facebook posted a message the other day that said, you know, if you feel unsafe in your home, send me a Facebook message as if you were ordering a pizza, and I'll know that I need to help you. And so I extend that message to anyone out in the world as well. If you need help, send me a personal Facebook message that you need a pizza, and we'll do the best we can to help you.
Fantastic. Brittany, we'll get some links set up so that it'll be easy for folks to find additional information. And I can't thank you enough for taking some time to talk with us about this really important topic and share some really useful information for the people who care and just want to do the right thing.
Thank you so much for the time, Lisa. I really, really appreciate it.
Brittany Robb is the Executive Director of Safe Haven Shelter and Resource Center, and she joined us this morning on Neighbors.
Oh, I get by with a little help from my friends. I get high with a little help from my friends. Gonna try with a little help from my friends.
It is 10:18, and you are listening to Neighbors. Taking a look at kind of the other side of the coin, a longtime guest of the program here on KUMD, Jeremy Neville Sorrell, but he's got a brand new job and a brand new title. He is now the director of the National Native Coalition of Men's Programs. Jeremy, it's been too long. It's great to have you back on the show. Good morning.
Good morning. Nice to visit with you again, Lisa.
You bet. You heard Brittany talk about the situation that they're seeing here in our community with Safe Haven, where folks being asked to quarantine with abusers or perhaps potential abusers who haven't quite worked up to that point yet. And there's so much concern about, we need to do this for public health, for kind of everybody as a whole, but it's a really dangerous situation for many people in a small section of our population. Talk about the work that you're doing with men and how the men that you work with and the organizations that you work with are finding that men are coping or handling or not coping or not handling this time.
Yes, it's absolutely the broad range that's going on across the country. I'm part of a couple different projects looking at not only domestic violence and the response in Native communities, but also on other work groups and looking at how are we changing the response to abusive partner intervention or batterers intervention programs and dealing with this whole COVID issue. You know, that in general, the work that we do around work with men who batter is so intervention type of work, and it's collaborative type of work. So you have people who, within the court system and human services system, all coordinate to ensure that this person is complete. complying with what they are court ordered to do or what the expectations are. So whether they go through criminal court and there are sanctions with that, or someone goes through the civil court process, and here in Minnesota you could check a box and ask for some type of offender treatment. So if a woman gets assaulted or feels threatened or any of those type of things, it's something that you can ask for on a civil protection order. And so if the court grants it, and then they'll be ordered into some type of program. And now the program is you know, a lot of people think of them as being very confrontational with men or maybe shaming with men, but it's the reality is of, you know, if we didn't care for men in our work, we wouldn't be doing this type of work, because we do believe men can change and we do see that they have the potential for change. It's all about how do we unpack where it all comes from, why it is we do the things that we do, why it is that we believe the way that we believe, and why do we choose to use violence in our relationship. And so that's a lot of the structure around the intervention. Part of the prevention work within my job is around engaging men, and we're having these conversations so we're not doing intervention later on. We'd rather do prevention, early intervention in a way, right, to provide information and awareness to get men think about what their actions and behaviors are so they don't end up in a situation where they're going to jail, hurting their partners, hurting their kids, or, you know, even go so far as killing people.
So what is it like for you and for, again, the people in the organizations that you work with? You talked a little bit about, obviously, how being really confrontational, you know, you wouldn't call somebody up and say, hey, do you want to smack somebody around now? How can we talk you out of doing that? Especially if they're really not at the place where they see that there's anything wrong, maybe, with what they're doing. How have you needed to change your approach during this time of quarantining? And obviously you're watching the same numbers that everybody else is watching and realizing that more men are being put in a position where they may make the wrong choice. And you need to do something for everybody's sake.
With the with the whole COVID response, we've had these issues around people in rural and remote areas having access to these type of services, and so it's been an issue within the field around, like, no, we can't do remote access. We want people to be in group, face to face, and do these things, because you get a different sense of the person and where they're at in their demeanor, and be able to read them differently to understand or see if there's any kind of threats or escalation, because their body language is so much different. And to now we absolutely need this type of response. We need to have some way to do this and reach out to people. And so some organizations have been doing remote access, and they've been doing it through video conferencing. Some of the people in Native communities in the rural areas, they just have to do audio calls. And so you have men who are, in general, there's the two sides of it. You got the men who are like, I don't want to wait till this thing is over so I can finish these classes and move on with my life, because who knows how long it's going to be. Some of these classes are only 6 months long. And so if you're sitting there waiting 6 months, and it's been, you know, we are getting close to 6 months of dealing with all this, someone could complete. So you have the people who want the ability to finish their court-ordered compliance, but then you also have the men who are needing and desiring that. Because when you find something that's hopeful and helpful to you, There's men who really embrace the program, and it becomes that sense of support. And the most effective programs are creating that sense of community and support, where you have an environment that's not really particularly healthy, and that's where the breeding ground for this whole behavior comes from, right? So you pull a man out of that environment and put him into a new environment, and you got to create a support network around that person so they don't go back. It's the same thing as alcoholism and drug addiction. You can't pull someone out of the environment that created them, help them make change, and then put them back in that environment and expect expect change to happen. It just doesn't work.
And right now, of course, it's really difficult for men to come together in that new environment because in a sense, the men are as much prisoners of the current situation as their partners might be.
Yeah.
So what are you and the people that you work with, what are they employing as best practices right now to just kind of keep everybody as safe as possible until, and then at the same time, you know, behind the scenes, try to figure out how can we do this going forward in a different way?
Yeah, there's a ton more outreach through social media, so which is very good, and you know that is helpful, and we also see a lot more men that individually reaching out and saying, you know, I understand that there's issues going on and people needing that support, needing someone to talk to. There's some of the groups across the country that, you know, the networks that are part of our network that you see them doing a lot of that, and you say, call me up if you need that help and support. One of the downsides is if you're not actively on social media, you're not going to see that.
Right.
And that's a lot of the situations. And that's the challenge, though, you know, because When people are in and abusive people are not the ones looking for help. Oftentimes, the abusive people don't understand that they have an issue. Like so much of the behavior that they grew up with, like, it is normal stuff. And a lot of people come from homes where there is abuse, so it's a learned pattern of behavior, and it's a lack of coping skills. You know, when I was facilitating group, and we'd always get to a section on, you know, we talk about all the violence they used and what happened in particular situations, and then we'd get to a point of asking them, what would you do differently? The men had no clue of what they could do differently. You know, they'd always struggle with that, and, you know, it becomes obvious after a while. You're like, well, if they had other skills, they wouldn't be in this group in the first place.
Right.
Other options.
But, you know, the group, I've seen how the group can be such a healing, how a group can be such a healing place.
Yeah.
People at different levels of, you know, progress and evolving, and somebody says, well, why don't you say this, or why don't you try this? You just sometimes need somebody to kind of spoon-feed you some of these answers until you get better at coming up with stuff that works for yourself.
You know, my favorite training line that I've been saying for years now is, you can't teach epiphanies.
Ah, yes.
You know, and that's what we're trying to do in groups and when we do awareness and education. So I would say, you can't teach epiphanies, but you can create opportunities for epiphanies to occur. So a lot of that is that self-directing. And like the previous speaker, like when you talk about, you know, people needing help and doing whatever, like you got to create options for people to see things a little differently, right? Got to be creative, like the calling, asking for a pizza is a sign for help. There's people got to stretch their brains a little bit to think differently, because they're usually locked in to say, well, this is what I continue to try over and over again. And so we do that with men in the same way. It's like, how do you look at things differently? And how do you look at your own response? And that's where it's really helpful having a lot of interaction, because when guys will get together, and even doing the work with organizing men across the country, I've talked about things that I've learned growing up that a man in L.A. talked about growing up, and a man over in Montana talked about growing up, all from three different environments, but we all have the same messages. You're like, how does that happen? And when you get guys together in a group, it really starts to resonate within him about, wow, there's so much like generalized messages that we hear and that are, you know, through multiple different ways. And then we start to go pull back to say, so what can we do differently? Right. And that's the thing that we're dealing with, a lot of the isolation issues, in that we're seeing a lot of people come into those stressors, and there's a lot of conflict, and there's a lot of tension, you know, growing, where people are like, oh, I want to go out and, you know, talk about their freedoms as being able to run out and about, and you're like, well, you know, that's very different. You can still go outside, right?
Right. Exactly.
If you really want to work, go get a job as an essential worker.
You know, there you are, and then you can do as much outside as you want.
Exactly.
Jeremy,
I'm
really looking forward to talking with you again about this topic, because as you go forward into the new normal, it sounds like you're going to have to amend something that's really, really working. It's going to have to work, but it's going to have to work a little differently. And of course, this whole issue of internet access for folks in rural and remote locations and reservations is something that has been talked about for a while. I'm really hoping that it gets legs now and some money and some progress can start to be kind of made. But I want to thank you so very much for taking some time to talk to us about this morning and share your insights. Getting a fuller picture of the whole issue is invaluable. Thank you so much. Jeremy Neville Sorrell is the director of the National Native Coalition of Men's Programs, and he joined us this morning as our guest on Neighbors.